Isn't it frustrating when the enjoyment of life is spoilt? Isn't it frustrating when the enjoyment of life is spoilt by hardships that come our way? Or spoilt by the fact that we just can't somehow stop looking over our shoulder at other people, and that somehow stops us enjoying our life. Now, those things are almost universal in our society. We all experience hardships, and we all keep looking over our shoulder at other people, and that somehow means we enjoy our own life less. And it's really frustrating, because we would love to just get on and enjoy life. But we just can't stop the difficulties coming. And we just can't stop looking over our shoulder. And so life is not quite as enjoyable as it might be. It's frustrating, it's sad, and it's almost universal. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to rise above all that? Somehow not to let those things get in the way of our life. Wouldn't it be nice to find something that is so delightful that nothing can stop us from enjoying it? You know the way it is if you get up very early, and at this time of year it's slightly less early than it used to be, and it's still dark. And in Kensington there are no street lights, and so if it's a cloudless night you can see the stars across the sky. But as the eastern edge of the sky starts to brighten and sunrise gets close, across the sky from east to west the stars vanish. They're not gone anywhere, of course. What's happened is the light of the sun is so bright that you can't see the stars anymore. Wouldn't it be nice to find something in our life that is so delightful that the things that we normally see, the hardships of life and the achievements of others, we no longer see them? Because this delightful sun that we keep looking at is so bright, those other things have vanished. The letter of Philippians shows that there is such a thing. This is a letter all about rejoicing. There are no fewer than 9 references in this letter to the word joy or to the word rejoice. It's a letter about joy. The expectation of the letter of Philippians is that the Christian life should be an experience of joy. That was Paul's experience. So if you look at verse 18 of that reading that David read, he says, "In that I rejoice." That was Paul's experience. He rejoiced. In that, in what, Paul? Well, in spite of some great pressures that could easily have sapped the joy out of him, he rejoices. Paul managed to rejoice through life. He wants the Philippians to do the same. He wants us to do the same. And Paul wants to teach us this morning how those same pressures need not sap our joy. So what was it then that Paul was rejoicing in? What was the bright sun for Paul that made the stars fade away? What is the good news that is such good news that it can make our life one of joy? Well, it's this. Paul rejoiced because of the spread of the gospel. Paul rejoiced because of the spread of the gospel. That's why he says he rejoices. Verse 12. "I want you to know that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel." Verse 18, "Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice." So what is this gospel that Paul is rejoicing to see spread? Well, 3 little details. Firstly, it's the message about Jesus. So did you notice how in that reading, proclaiming Christ and preaching the gospel are almost interchangeable? The gospel that he's rejoicing in is the message of Jesus spreading and advancing. Second little detail is the word gospel means literally good news. The Christian message is a message of good news. Just as a herald in the ancient days would have had a message to send back to the capital city, to the rulers, and would have run or ridden on horseback with this desperately good news message to proclaim. The Christian message, the message about Jesus, is good news. And so thirdly, it's knowing that it's spreading that makes Paul rejoice. Now this gives us a perspective on our life, doesn't it? We could rejoice in the same thing. Some of us have never perhaps discovered that the Christian message is good news. That's a new idea to some of us. I meet people all the time who aren't aware that the Christian message is good news. They think it's bad news or neutral, but it's good. It's the good news that God loves us, that God sent his son to die for us so that we could have our sins forgiven, so that we could be a child of his, and so that we could be assured a future in a renewed world. The Christian message is amazingly good news. It's the best news in the world. It's wonderful. And some of us have perhaps never discovered that. And today is the chance to start to realize that's what it's all about. Others of us perhaps need reminding that the Christian message is good news. Perhaps we knew that once, but somehow we've forgotten. It slipped. Some of us, let's face it, were so glum that nobody would ever know that we're carrying around the best news that anybody has ever heard. So if you look at somebody who's just got engaged, you look at somebody who's just got married, you look at somebody who's just been told that they got the job they went to the interview for, you look at somebody who's just passed their driving test, you look at somebody who's just had their first grandchild, and you just know, don't you? They have this kind of visible glow, and you don't know what's wrong, but you know that they are carrying inside the most amazing news for them that there ever is. You just know. Well, the Christian message is far better news than any of those things. And people looking at us should just know. And so perhaps some of us need reminding that it's good news. But Paul's being a bit more precise than that. He's not just saying that the Christian message is good news. It's the idea that the spread of that message is the cause for joy. The spread of the message. Now, maybe that's new for more of us. It's certainly interesting for me thinking about it this week. It got me thinking. You see, if you hear, for example, of a group of people in Iran becoming Christians, so that just a few months ago, a printing press in Iran, I don't know where it is, and it's better I don't, isn't it, printed 100,000 copies of the New Testament in Persian. Those copies have already gone. Now, if you know anything about Iran, that is amazing. 100,000 copies. 100,000 Iranians want to read the New Testament in their own language. You hear that? What happens? If you hear of a brand new church starting in Seven Oaks, what happens? If you hear of the latest census in New Zealand as showing vast numbers of growth in committed Christians, what happens to you? Does it make something inside you dance? Does it put a smile on the face, the like of which you've not known for some time? Does your heart miss a beat with excitement? It did for Paul, and it can for us. And if we find that we don't share the joy that Paul felt, then perhaps what we need to do is dwell again on what good news the Christian message is. How wonderful that God sent his son to save us. God of grace, amazing wonder, irresistible, true. Perhaps we need to dwell again on how wonderful it is that we can be forgiven, that we can be God's child. How wonderful it is that we can have a certain future to look forward to. What amazing things God's done for us. Think about that until it starts to sink in. And then think how wonderful that hundreds, thousands, millions of others are coming to discover the same thing. Wow. Paul rejoiced because of the spread of the gospel. It's a bit like the spread of democracy. People today regard democracy as a good thing, don't they? And it is. It is a good thing. But it's not the best thing. Winston Churchill was far more cautious in the way he described democracy. I think it was Churchill. Someone put me right if I'm wrong. He said that of all the forms of government, democracy has the least problems. So it's good. You probably can't improve upon it, but it's not perfect. Was that Churchill or was that somebody else? People seem to think it was Churchill, but nobody's desperately confident. Perhaps we should have a church outing to his old home and ask them there. They'll tell us. See, democracy won't save the world. But we have something that has and will. So if we look at how excited some Westerners are when they hear that another country has embraced democracy, how much more excited can we be when we hear of people rejoicing to embrace the Christian gospel? Paul rejoiced because of the spread of the gospel. Now, there are two things that could have stopped Paul rejoicing at the spread of the gospel. There are two things that could have sapped the joy right out of the Philippians. Two things that could sap the joy from us. And they are the sufferings of life and the successes of others. And Paul didn't let them get in the way, and neither should we. So we're going to look briefly at each of those two in turn. So firstly then, the sufferings of life. The Philippians wanted to know what had happened to Paul. They were concerned. They'd heard rumors. They wanted to know his news. What had happened? Actually, quite a lot had happened. This letter was probably written from prison in Rome, and you can read in the book of Acts about how he came to be in prison in Rome. In short, he went to Jerusalem, and there he went into the temple to demonstrate to the Jews that he wasn't ignoring their precious customs. But there was a riot because they didn't believe him, and he ended up in Roman custody for his own protection. He was actually then left in custody for several years because the various successive governors were all hoping for a bribe to try and release him. He ended up being transferred to Caesarea, where he was still left in custody, and finally he gave up and had to appeal to the emperor to try and put an end to all this nonsense. So began his perilous journey to Rome, which involved a shipwreck and a potentially lethal snake bite. He then gets to Rome and spends 2 years under house arrest, which could any day have ended either with release or with execution. He didn't know. Now, most of us, if we had that kind of life, would be delighted to be asked by the Philippians, "Tell me, how's it been going?" Because that question gives us the excuse we need to unburden our tale of woe. What does Paul do? He's not interested in what happened to him. Verse 12, "I want you to know that what's happened to me has really served to advance the gospel." What's important to Paul is what's happened not to him, but to the gospel through what's happened to him. His ups and downs are neither here nor there in comparison. And the gospel has spread. It's spread outside the church because his imprisonment has meant that the whole guard now knows about Jesus. And that must be because he used his imprisonment to speak for Jesus. After all, one prisoner looks much like another. How would they know unless he spoke? And also, Paul saw his imprisonment as his posting. He says, "I'm put here for the defense of the gospel. This is where I've been stationed. It's my placement to be telling people about Jesus here in prison." The gospel also spread inside the church as the Christians in Rome were emboldened to tell other people about Jesus. Paul doesn't explain how that worked, but perhaps what happened was people saw his chains, saw his courage, and thought, actually, we could stand up for Jesus too, couldn't we? We could speak for Jesus. It's worth being brave. So Paul's imprisonment did not lock up the gospel. As he says elsewhere, God's word is not chained. But God used Paul's imprisonment to spread the gospel. Paul has his conviction that God's in charge, that even the bad things that happen can be used by God to spread the good news of Jesus. And so on balance, he looks at what's happened to him. He sees the sufferings, he sees the spread of the gospel, and the detail that he wants to relay to the Philippians is the spread of the gospel. So he rejoices to see it spread, and his rejoicing is not obstructed by his hardships. Now we can apply this to us as individuals, can't we? Do you see what a radical perspective this is? You ask most people today, "How's your job going?" What will they say? They'll tell you about the promotion they did or did not get. They'll tell you about the colleagues they enjoy or are frustrated by. They'll tell you about the long or the short hours. They'll tell you about a particular project they're working on. This tells us that if you're thinking about how's your job going, instead of asking those things, you can ask the question, "How is the gospel spreading through the job I've got?" So, for example, it would allow someone to see the fact they missed out on promotion as a good thing because their evenings are now free so they can take a friend to Christianity Explored. "So my job's going very well, thank you. God's using my lack of promotion to spread the gospel." That's how radical this is. Ask most people how their family's going. What will they tell you? They'll tell you about their latest grandchild. They'll tell you about the baby that's teething. They'll tell you about the taxi service they run for their teenage children. They'll tell you about the latest care that their elderly parents require. "Paul, how's your family doing?" Well, what I'm wanting to think about, he says, as I answer that, is how is the gospel spreading through the way things have been going in my family? Turns it on its head. Now, don't get me wrong, hardships are real, but they don't need to sap our joy at the spread of the gospel. Even when we do suffer, God is able to use that to spread the good news about Jesus. And he will do it if, like Paul, we regard the circumstances in our lives as our posting for this year, and we keep living for Christ, and we keep speaking for him. That's applying it to us as individual people. How about us as a church together? There will be times in the future when things happen to us as a church that look like enormous setbacks. I've known churches where they had, within the space of 1 year, an unnatural number of people fall ill and die. The church finances under great pressure, problems in their building, and a number of very involved people in the life of the church move away from the area for one reason or another. All in 1 year. When that happens, it's really hard. But God is in charge. And he invites us to regard that as our posting for the year. Which doesn't mean we might have to face some very hard decisions together. Things could get even worse. But rather than focusing on the difficulties, we focus on being faithful to our calling and making the most of this year to be the year when we spread the gospel. So if someone asks you, how's your church doing? Not job, not family, church this time. What do you tell them? Do you tell them about the music that you like or don't like? Do you tell them about the liturgy that you like or don't like? Do you tell them about the church finances that are good or bad? Do you tell them about particular people in the church that you like or dislike? Or do you stop and pause and ask, how's the gospel spreading in our church? And I might think, I might have particular bits of the church. I think this is good or this is bad. But then I stop and say, is that thing leading to the spread of the gospel? That is the important thing. The gospel is such good news. And God is so much in charge that there is no need for sufferings, however real, to stop us rejoicing at its spread. So Paul rejoices at the spread of the gospel, and he's not obstructed by the sufferings of life. Not obstructed by the sufferings of life, neither by the successes of others. Here's the problem. Others have been emboldened to preach Christ, he says. But their motives are mixed. Some are doing it for good reasons, out of love, to carry on Paul's good work while he's in prison. But others are doing it out of rivalry. It's a chance to get ahead. They're doing it insincerely. They're wanting to rub salt into Paul's wounds and establish their own empire while he's off the block. They don't sound any better than the housing estate drug dealer who takes advantage of the other one being locked up to build their own bit of territory. That's how they're treating Paul. What these different people have in common is they're all preaching the real Christ, the real gospel. They're not false teachers. Paul's got some very harsh words for them later in Philippians. They're teaching the real thing. But Paul's reaction is a huge surprise. What then, verse 18? What does it matter? Not at all. We'd expect it to matter a great deal, wouldn't we? People are trying to hurt him. You'd have thought he'd be annoyed, wound up. You'd have thought he'd be trying to correct their false motives. See, what does it matter? What does it matter? Why doesn't it matter, Paul? Well, if we followed him this far, we know the answer, don't we? What does it matter? Christ is proclaimed. The gospel is spreading. And as long as that is happening, I rejoice. So just as what matters is not his suffering, but the spread of the gospel, so what matters is not the motives of others, but the spread of the gospel. And so he rejoices, and the jealousy of others, the rivalry of others, the competitiveness of others does not get in his way. Now, we're forever blighted today by competitiveness. I don't know if any of you remember, back in 2004, 6 years ago, there was a 90-minute program on the telly called Christmas Lights. Starred Robson Green and Mark Benton, a few nods. Two brothers-in-law who live three doors apart. Right? Colin puts Christmas lights on the outside of his house. Howard sees them and has to get some bigger and brighter ones than Colin. Colin sees those and has to get some bigger and brighter ones than Howard. And the escalation just continues and threatens to rip both households apart. It's a parable for how many of us live, always looking over our shoulder. What are they doing? Now, competitiveness isn't always bad. The Commonwealth Games would be very dull if everyone was always trying to let everybody else win. But when you have competitiveness between churches or within churches, it's really ugly. And one reason why it's ugly is that it saps our joy. So that we don't rejoice at something good because we're too busy looking over our shoulders. We can't enjoy our Christmas because we're too busy looking at the neighbours. We can't enjoy looking at their lights because we're too busy worrying about the fact that they're not quite, that they're slightly better than ours. And so we don't rejoice in the spread of the gospel because we're hung up on the motivation of the person who's preaching it. So wouldn't it be sad if somebody within this church wasn't able to rejoice at seeing the gospel spread because of some grievance within church life? Or because the spread was happening in an area of church life that they weren't involved in? Wouldn't that be sad? Wouldn't it be sad if they weren't able to rejoice because the spread was happening amongst the wrong kinds of people? People who are too old, too young, too fat, too thin, too short, too tall, too rich, too poor. And so we can't rejoice because it's growth of those, not growth of these. That's within our church. What about between our two churches? Do we rejoice at hearing the gospel spread in the other church? That's why this combined service is so important, 4 times a year. Gives us a chance to meet together and hear the good news of what's going on in each other's churches and say, I feel really good for you. That's great to hear that. Or are we too tied up with resenting the fact that it was them and not us? So when we hear somebody else from Woodlands or from Kemsing say that was good in our church, we frown and we groan because we're thinking, why them, not us? If you hear of increasing numbers of youth, increasing regular attendance, a new person or a new couple who have just joined, how do you react? With joy or wishing it was your church? Within our church, within each other's churches, other churches in the area, if you hear of another church seeing growth or they've run some program or an activity that's made the gospel known, how do you react? Do you resent it or rejoice? The town church had a great party for kids yesterday. Lots of kids there hearing about Jesus. Wonderful. Some flyers left at the back of church. Pick up to find out what children you know missed. A few from Kemsing went. That was them. Hooray! The gospel's spreading. That's what we should be saying. Occasionally people tell me about one church or another. It could be a number of different churches. And there's something in that particular church they're telling me about that they don't like. Perhaps a decision they've made about their finances. Perhaps a program they've run. Perhaps something they're not doing. Perhaps some priorities or emphases that they've got. Perhaps their motives. So far, so fine. We can talk about other churches. We can pick up on things we don't like. That's fine. That's normal. Although I personally think it's always better to talk to somebody rather than to talk about somebody. But we're allowed to kind of say that perhaps is a bit skewed. The problem comes with the next step. When people say, and I don't like that church. That is not fine. Even if their motives are wrong, even if their decisions are damaging, even if their emphases are totally off track, if the gospel is advancing, flawed though they may be, we rejoice with them, and they are our partners. It is too easy for the fact that it wasn't us who did it to cause our rejoicing to evaporate. Isn't it sad? In the world around us, when people cannot enjoy themselves because they focus on their hardships or they focus on what others are doing. Isn't it even sadder when the church is no different? After all, we've got the best news in the world. And we have the privilege of being part of spreading it to the ends of the earth. We have cause to rejoice more than anybody. And what a shame if we don't, because of the sufferings of life or the successes of others. Let's not let those things get in the way. But let's rejoice whenever we hear that the gospel is spreading. Even if God does it through some very tough times, and even if somebody else was involved that we don't entirely approve of.